Welcome to this audio presentation on critically reflective learning. My starting point is to emphasise that to get critically reflective learning, we need to begin with reflective practice. From reflective practice, we can move to reflective learning, and then from reflective learning, we can focus on critically reflective learning. So let's begin then by looking at reflective practice. This is an idea that is closely associated with the educational theorist Donald Schoen. What Schoen was interested in terms of reflective practice was the idea of going beyond technical rationality. Now, what he meant by technical rationality is the idea that professionals can be given instructions on how to do their job, a sort of manual of instructions. Schoen recognised that professional life isn't like that, and professional education should not be like that either. That what happens in professional practice is a much more flexible and creative process. As I like to put it, it's not a case of painting by numbers. There's much more to it than that. So Schoen's idea of reflective practice was the idea that people need to be thinking carefully about what they're doing, drawing on their professional knowledge base, rather than just looking for some sort of mechanistic procedure to follow. He drew an important distinction between what he called the high ground and the swampy lowlands. The high ground is a metaphor for the professional knowledge base. It refers to theoretical understandings, to the research base, and so on. And so the high ground is seen as a somewhere where we have an overview of practice, where we can see patterns and interconnections that we may not notice while we are down in what he called the swampy lowlands of practice. He acknowledged that practice can be difficult, complex, fraught with dilemmas and contradictions, and can sometimes seem a long way away from the relative clarity of the high ground. But for Schoen, the idea of being a reflective practitioner was to be able to, while wading through those swampy lowlands, to draw on the professional knowledge base, to use the insights from the high ground, and therefore, in a sense, integrate theory and practice. That then enables us to make sense of the complexities of the situations we encounter in practice. So one of the reasons that reflective practice has become such a popular topic in professional education over the years is that it helps to move away from the traditional artificial gap between theory and practice, as if they occupy different territories altogether with no connection. So Schoen's work, and that of others who followed in his footsteps, has been very helpful in terms of developing a better understanding of the relationship between theory and practice, between knowing and doing. A good analogy is the idea that a reflective practitioner tailors their knowledge to the situation. That is, they create a garment to fit the circumstances based on their knowledge base. They're not looking for off-the-peg solutions, which is what, in a sense, technical rationality would be about. Reflective practice can perhaps be summed up in one phrase, which is the idea of a reflective conversation with the situation. That's a term that Schoen used to describe the idea that what we should be doing is engaging with the situations we encounter in practice and using our knowledge base to make sense of them. Hence the idea of a reflective conversation, a to-ing and fro-ing between the knowing and the doing, the theory and the practice. So that's reflective practice in a nutshell. Let's see how that now relates to reflective learning. Well, we can see that there is a relationship between the two in at least two ways. First of all, it has to be acknowledged that without reflective practice, then there can be no reflective learning. So if somebody is not practicing in a reflective way, if they are just relying on routines, habits, copying others, basing what they do on guesswork or whatever, where there is no clear rationale for what they do, which is linked to their professional knowledge base and experience, then we cannot describe that as reflective practice. And if there is no reflective practice, then reflective learning is not going to be possible either. But there's also a second way in which we can relate reflective learning to reflective practice. And that's in the sense that reflective learning also involves a reflective conversation with the situation. So reflective learning means looking at our experience in practice and asking ourselves, what lessons can be learned from this? What sort of things are there that emerge from our practice that could be useful learning points for us? So it involves asking ourselves, as part of this reflective conversation, asking ourselves such questions as, how might we do things differently next time? What will we do more of? What will we do less of? What ideas were particularly useful or insightful? What pitfalls did we become aware of so that we can avoid them in future? Now, it's important that we ask ourselves those questions explicitly, that we take the time and effort that is required to focus on our learning to make it happen. And I'll come back in a moment to the idea that it won't happen by magic, just by having an experience. But for now, I want to emphasize this point that we need to be asking ourselves these questions. One of the dangers is that learning will not take place because reflection does not take place. Sadly, it's not uncommon for practitioners and indeed managers to become so busy that they enter a sort of hamster wheel, that they're rushing from one thing to the next. It's often been said to me, for example, on training courses, that reflective practice and reflective learning are great ideas, but they're just not realistic in practice, that people are too busy to do them. I've always responded in exactly the same way to that comment by saying that that is a significant misunderstanding of reflective practice. Reflective practice and indeed reflective learning are not luxuries that we may or may not be able to afford. They are essential building blocks of good practice, of safe professional practice. So my response to the idea that we don't have time to be reflective would be the opposite of what people might expect, and that is that the busier we are, the more reflective we need to be. The more we're under pressure, the more we need to be focusing and clear about what we're doing, why we're doing it, whether we are the right person to be doing it, whether this is enough of a priority to do now, or whether it should wait till later, and so on and so forth. If we are just responding in an unthinking, uncritical way to our pressures, we are in very dangerous waters. So reflective practice and reflective learning are definitely not a luxury that many people cannot afford because they're so busy. They can be, in a sense, an antidote to being so busy by taking the time, and it doesn't have to be a great deal of time, but taking the time to reflect on what we're doing, to plan, to think clearly about what our priorities are, to learn from our experience so that we don't make the same mistakes again, that we identify what we do well so that we can do it even better, and so on. These are all important parts of the need to recognize that it is a significant mistake to assume that reflection is somehow an added extra. It should be seen as a fundamental part of good practice. Now, another important point to recognize about reflective learning is that learning is an active process, not a passive one. So learning doesn't happen by magic. It is commonly said that experience is the best teacher. But in reality, that's not the case. I'm sure we've all come across people who have years and years of experience, but they've learnt little or nothing from them. Experience in itself will teach us nothing. What is the best teacher is what we do with experience, how we process it in a sense, how we make sense of it, how we draw out the lessons from it, and that, in a sense, is precisely what reflective learning is about. Being able to weigh up situations we've been involved with and draw out the key learning points from that so that we're able to answer some of those questions I mentioned before. What will we do differently next time? What will we do more of? What will we do less of? And so on. If we are able to draw out those lessons from our practice, then what we are doing in effect is reaping the harvest of learning from experience. Because to reiterate, experience will teach us nothing. Experience in itself just provides the raw materials for learning. It's just like having the raw materials for building a house, for example, does not give us a house. It just gives us a set of raw materials that we cannot live in. So it's about drawing out the learning from the experience. I mentioned a moment ago that learning does not happen by magic, and that point is worth emphasising because magical thinking is something that is associated with childhood, how children think, for example, if they really, really want a bike enough for Christmas, they'll get one. That failure to see links between cause and effect, for example. Now, in theory, we grow out of magical thinking, but I'm not totally convinced that we do completely. For example, I've come across a lot of magical thinking on training courses where people seem to think that by sitting through a training course, joining in discussions, will somehow, as if by magic, make them better at their job. In fact, I often finish off training courses I run by making the point that that will not happen, that learning has to be active, that they have to actively identify what are the learning points they are taking away from that day and how they're going to put them into practice. If that process doesn't happen, learning won't happen and the training course will in effect have been a complete waste of time. So it's important that we're clear that reflective learning is an active process. We have to make it happen. It won't necessarily happen of its own accord. Just like a house won't build itself just by putting the bricks and mortar, etc., all in the same place. So, to sum up then, in terms of reflective learning, experience is not the best teacher. It's what we do with that experience. We have to make sense of it. We have to have that reflective conversation with the situation. That is the hallmark of reflective practice itself. That now brings us on to the third element of my presentation, which is critically reflective learning. Now, this is an extension of the notion of reflective learning with the critical bit added. So critically reflective learning needs to incorporate an element of criticality. And what I mean by criticality is questioning, not taking things for granted. So it's different from the idea of being critical in the everyday sense. It's not about criticising. It's about being able to look beyond the presenting situation, to look at it more analytically, in a sense. Now, for me, I like to think of critically reflective learning and indeed critically reflective practice in terms of critical breadth and critical depth. So let's have a look at what each of these refers to. First, critical breadth. I have often made the point that we are all unique individuals. Every human being on the planet is a unique individual. But we are all unique individuals in a social context. Sadly, that second bit, the idea of the social context, often gets forgotten. People look upon individuals very often as unique beings in their own right. but fail to recognise that there will be certain patterns that are associated with the social context. So there will be, for example, gender differences, cultural differences, linguistic differences, a whole range of social factors that will have a bearing on the people involved in the situation, and indeed a bearing on the situation itself. So this links in with anti-discriminatory practice, for example. If we regard a certain person as a unique individual in their own right, but we don't recognise that perhaps that person may be subject to sexism or racism or ageism or disablism or whatever, then we are missing a significant part of that person's life experience. The reflective conversation we're having with the situation will be based on a very narrow understanding of that situation and could be missing out some crucial aspects of that person's life experience that they are bringing to the situation. And in some circumstances, that can mean that we are adding to discrimination if we are not recognising the impact of discrimination on somebody's life. We may actually be reinforcing or unwittingly condoning that discrimination by neglecting the significance of its impact. So in terms of critical breadth, we have to look beyond the individual. This is not a case of forgetting that every individual is unique. We need to hold on to that idea. It's very important. But we have to understand the other side of the coin as well. We're all unique individuals in a social context. The technical term is that what we're doing, or what I'm advocating, is avoiding atomism. Atomism is a philosophical term that refers to the danger of seeing individuals in isolation as atoms and not seeing them as part of a broader whole. So that's the idea then of critical breadth. Now, alongside that, we also need critical depth. And this is about not taking things at face value or adopting a superficial approach. So, for example, it includes being analytical of looking at a situation, asking questions about it, trying to identify patterns, significant issues that are there, rather than just taking it superficially at face value as presented. For example, it is often the case that what is presented as a problem is in a way a reflection of a deeper or a wider problem. And so if we focus narrowly on the presenting problem, we may very well miss the significance of a deeper problem. And so it's important that we don't skate across the surface, as it were, and just see things as they're presented to us. So critical depth means being prepared to look more carefully, more critically, at a situation to try and identify what is going on beneath the surface, as it were. So critically reflective learning involves the reflective learning, as I've outlined above, but with the added dimensions of critical breadth and critical depth. So to conclude then, critically reflective learning involves, first of all, engaging in reflective practice. If we're not practicing reflectively, if we're just routinely on automatic pilot, as it were, responding to the demands made of us, getting into unthinking habits, then not much learning is going to take place. So step one is reflective practice. Step two is reflective learning, to have that reflective conversation with the situation, to pull out the key learning points from our experience so that we're better equipped. We're constantly learning from our experience, constantly getting stronger and better equipped in what we do. And then finally, we need to make sure that that reflective learning includes critical breadth and critical depth so that we're not missing out key aspects of the situation. I hope you found this presentation helpful. And good luck in putting it into practice. Thank you.